Film screenwriter and director Cameron Crowe is my guest on the Cafe today. His films include Jerry Maguire, Say Anything, Singles, Almost Famous, and his latest, Elizabethtown. First, as a teenager, Crowe was a rock journalist, and Almost Famous is kind of a fictionalized account of his early years. He's married to Nancy Wilson of Heart. His films have always mirrored his love of music, and we'll talk about the soundtracks today. In fact, I started off by asking Cameron Crowe if he had ever written a scene into one of his films just so he could use a song.
Tried to, and it never quite works. There's a group of songs that I've tried to find a home for, Come Pick Me Up by Ryan Adams being one, and usually if they're truly great songs, they don't want your movie. They literally are a better movie in your head when you listen to the song, and it's funny. You can count on it. You put a great song on a scene that you might love and think would be right. Sure enough, that song is more eloquent than what you have on film. So it's every once in a while you get that marriage between what you know is a great song and then you've managed to give it a home in film. And that's cool.
Oh, is there a song in Elizabethtown that actually started you thinking this is perfect for the soundtrack or for the feel of the film?
Long Ride Home. Long Ride Home by Patty Griffin, which always felt to me like an oddly uplifting and soulful song about loss, and just kind of set the bar for what kind of movie you could do that could begin with failure and end with just a real celebration of life.
Long black limousine, shiniest car I've ever seen. Backseat is nice and clean. She rides as quiet as a dream. Someone dug a hole 6 long feet in the ground. I said goodbye to you and I threw my roses down. Ain't nothing left at all in the end of being proud with me riding in this car and you flying through them clouds. I've had some time to think about it and watch the sun sing like a storm. I've had some time to think about you on the long ride home.
It's interesting that you picked that Patty Griffin song because it fits perfectly, and also, you know, musically fits with Kentucky and the scene.
Now,
the Elton John song here also seems to fit well, although it's obviously comes from a different place.
My Father's Gun is one of those evocative, great Elton John songs from the first couple albums that he did. And really, that album, Tumbleweed Connection, was sort of his Elizabethtown, you know, kind of a look at an America and a snapshot in time and the traditions and family. And so I always thought, you know, if we do our job right and get the right actor and audition him with the song, that we'll have a little showcase for My Father's Gun. And that's exactly what happened. Orlando Bloom he worked with that song in the scene where he looks over his father's casket and kind of peers inside, and that enormously kind of personal moment that then cuts to the celebration of the family in the kitchen and this visitation dinner that's part of the grand southern tradition of saying goodbye. That cut, I thought, if My Father's Gun gets us across that cut to take us from death to life and we're basically on this one guy's face, we're home. And that's how Orlando got the job.
From this day on, I own my father's gun. We dug a shallow grave.
And you're also talking about something that happens in your films a lot. It's about how the emotional aspect is complete. I mean, the performance has to be there, but the emotional aspect is so heightened by what you choose to put behind it. And one of the chances you really had to do that was kind of in The Road Trip. Being able to do that. I'm curious, have you ever done that for somebody as in Elizabethtown, the character takes a road trip and has an elaborate accompaniment. have you ever done that for somebody? Or
I have, for myself. How sad is that? How sad is that? And I've made road trip tapes for Nancy, my wife, who does the score for the movie and stuff. But for some reason, the whole idea of go to this place and listen to this song at this time, nobody had ever really done it for me, man. And I'm such a road traveling guy, and it's where you kind of get your best ideas and save new CDs to listen to in that way where you can roll down the window and let the wind kind of be a part of the experience. I really do that. And I always knew that Elizabethtown needed to end with that experience. Even if it's saying to people, okay, for the next 15 minutes, it's an ending you didn't expect, but strap in, we're going to see part of America, and it's going to be a very personal journey from one character who's a traveler to another who isn't. And that is how Elizabethtown needed to end and does end.
We're talking with Cameron Crota today, the director and screenplay writer, and before all that, he was a writer at a very young age for Rolling Stone, and if you've ever seen Almost Famous, you know that a lot of his experiences are in that film. Does that film still feel pretty accurate, appraisal of the precocious you?
Yeah, I think best of all is that's the movie that, as we've kind of gone around the world and talked about Elizabethtown, that's the one that people really kind of tap you on the shoulder and say, can we sit down for a second and talk about Almost Famous?
Hmm.
It really is interesting. You know what's great is usually it's that guy that you'd see on the street who you'd think, well, this is a guy who's been trapped in the corporate world selling insurance or whatever for his entire life, but that guy wants to talk about Almost Famous, and you see in his eyes, this guy went to 100 Ted Nugent shows. It's still in him. He communicated with that movie, though he couldn't be a rock star. That movie kind of caught what it was to fall in love with rock, and that's really my favorite thing about it.
Now, you've been lucky enough to have, lines from movies kind of go into the vernacular, and, you know, I'm thinking of Show Me the Money, or You Had Me at a Low, things like that from Jerry Maguire. But I have to say that the scene in Almost Famous where everybody's the tiny dancer scene in that film, it kind of fits, because I can talk to everybody has the same reaction to that film, that particular piece. When do you realize in the process that you have really hit a nerve with that, with something like that?
Well, thanks for the question. I'm still kind of, you know, grateful that the scene connected with people. It's an interesting thing. You know, there were some people when the movie came out that said, no, that would never happen. You'd never have a grizzled, hardened rock band singing along with a pop guilty pleasure. That would never happen. But, you know, as time goes on, it's the most hardened guys that have kind of gotten in touch with me and said, you know, we used to sing along to ABBA, but don't write it. Don't tell anyone, okay? That happened to us. And I really felt when we were filming the scene, it was based on the Marshall Tucker Band, who I'd been touring with, and they were singing, it wasn't Tiny Dancer, but it was that era of a pop song. And so for me, it felt autobiographical. And what's truly funny, if you get a chance to see that scene again on TV or whatever, at some point, if it ever comes up, look at Noah Taylor, who's the road manager. And he's such a great actor. Noah is a punk rocker at heart, and Noah just loathes Tiny Dancer. And the poor guy, it's like he's eating poisoned oysters. Look at his face trying to sing along with Tiny Dancer, and you will see really an accurate portrait of not everybody on the bus is that gleefully singing along. And it's just I can't take my eyes off him now when I see that scene.
Looking on, she sings the songs, the words she knows, tune she hums. But oh, how it feels so real, lying here with no one near, only you, and you can't hear. Slowly.
I was looking back over all the soundtracks you've done, and I went back to Ridgemont High, which, of course, wasn't your film. And that music for that film was kind of an earlier era. I mean, it really felt very Eagles and all that.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Singles was much more, it seemed more who you were at the time.
Yeah.
And I'm curious how your taste has changed over the years, because obviously it has to, whatever you choose for film has to fit the particular place, et cetera. But certainly Elizabethtown's soundtrack is very, very different than what some of the other things you've done in the past.
Well, each movie is really an attempt to have a mini radio station. And some days the radio station plays some kinds of music and sometimes others. I love everything. Elizabethtown was meant to kind of be American acoustic soul. You know, not necessarily R&B, but what is... You know, and probably with the leaning towards singer-songwriters, because there's so many great ones right now. But it is like the American roots soul music. And then, you know, if you're in that kind of groove, you want to give Kathleen Edwards, you know, a showcase, and My Morning Jacket, and Ryan Adams, and Patty Griffin, and now you're starting to really create a sound for a movie, and that was how Elizabethtown began. And then I want them all to be a mixtape, not necessarily. I mean, over the years, soundtracks have kind of become these marketing tools, and I sort of always craved the time of The Graduate and Harold and Maude and movies like that, where you wanted a souvenir of the experience, and you could actually find this long playing record that puts you in the vibe. And so the soundtracks we've done, Singles also really was constructed as a mix that you can just put on from beginning to end, and it casts a spell, hopefully, that matches the movie. And that's probably the most fun part of the process for me.
Mm-hmm. No, that was going to particularly point to that one as one of those. But that one's interesting to me because it's all these Seattle bands, and then Paul Westerberg from Minnesota, who's kind of stuck in there. Why did he fit for you for that movie?
Well, it's funny. That's really a great question, because I think even Paul wondered that when he came to Seattle to work on some of the music, and he went to one of the happening bars, and he was just sitting alone at the bar, and everybody else kind of, you know, in the dawn and the early flush of Seattle rock, they were all hanging, and they loved Westerberg, but they didn't know how to approach him. And I guess we were just trying to breed this kind of marriage of the two, because I think, you know, Cobain and most of those other guys really had to claim The Replacements as one of their big influences. So that was our attempt to kind of crossbreed. Don't know that it really took. But the funny thing about Singles is all those bands, Mother Love Bone, which became Pearl Jam, and Mudhoney and Screaming Trees, and and then from Chicago, Billy Corgan sent in some music because he had become friends with Chris Cornell. It was all kind of a secret that we were sharing, this music that you heard all the time in Seattle but nowhere else. And so there were some jokes built into the movie, like this Seattle sound. And over the course of the time that the movie was finished and the studio didn't want to release it, Nirvana took off. And suddenly there was a Seattle sound. And the movie did come out. And it was so funny that people then thought, oh, well, they raced out a movie to capitalize on the Seattle sound. But in fact, it had been done a year and a half earlier, and all those bands had worked behind the camera and done artwork, and it was such a kind of a community thing that music went from being, you know, an obscure local mix to being kind of a showcase of a globally loved sound. And that was the interesting little ride of Singles.
Yeah, it's kind of like the harder they come for early grunge in the soundtrack department. So that
song Seasons by Chris Cornell to me is the heart of the album, because that was a joke song. That was a song that Chris Cornell wrote as a joke to go along with the fake one of the fake song titles on a cassette that Matt Dillon sells on a street corner in Singles. And he kind of went into his basement and did his first solo thing as a joke, you know, a tape that he had somebody give to me and say, oh, look, I found this. I bought this on a street corner. And I put in Seasons and thought, you know, geez, Cornell really can do it all.
to hide it all, and I'm lost behind the words I'm near.
Seasons, Chris Cornell's tune, ending up being written for singles, since we're talking with Cameron Crowe about the music in his films today, including the new Elizabethtown, which is in the theaters as we speak. Cameron, I want to talk a little bit about more about you growing up, because I think you had kind of an interesting upbringing in that music was for a while not allowed in your household, yet it seems that your parents had a big influence on you musically.
Hugely, because the scene in Almost Famous that really is childhood for me is Frances McDormand holding up that copy of the Simon and Garfunkel album saying, "Look at their faces. They're high. They have taken pot. Look at them." And I remember, you know, my sister and I kind of looking at the album cover going, "Yeah, maybe it's true, but they're literate and they're intelligent, Mom." And she's like, "Doesn't matter. They're on pot." And I think years later when the movie came out, Paul Simon was doing an interview on CNN. And they said, "You know, did you see Almost Famous? And did you see that ridiculous scene where Frances McDormand holds up your album cover for Bookends and claims you're on pot? What did you think of that?" And apparently Paul Simon said, "Well, we were on pot." Which... that was a huge victory for my mom, though, you know, we really didn't want to give her that at the time. But, you know, the cool thing about my mom is she later, because Dick Cavett, and I think this stuff has finally come out on DVD, but because Dick Cavett was an intelligent late night talk show guy and had on Jimi Hendrix, she kind of begrudgingly let Hendrix into the house, and then it was all over from there.
And I think you're also a pretty interesting combination of loner plus kind of insider. I mean, at a very early age, you went from, you know, a guy who would hang out alone writing or listening to music to being backstage. And I just think that is such an unusual combination. I'm really not sure what the question is here, but how does that affect you as a person to know both sides of that story?
Well, it's a great question because, you know, most people that connect so strongly to rock and music and hip hop now are loners, people that feel like they're not understood. Where is the person that understands what I'm going through? And that's when music affects you so strongly. And I still feel like a loner. And all the musicians that I kind of snuck backstage and started to interview were loners. And their greatest music, beginning with Pete Townsend, who gave me a 4-hour interview for a 500-word blurb of a story, he was a loner. So I felt not alone in the state of lonerness. and still that's where writing comes from, and being able to kind of face the empty page and create a world of characters is still, I mean, that and then filling it in with music is the greatest part of what I get to do. I mean, it's a hobby that grew, and I'm really proud to have the opportunity to make a movie, hopefully more than every 4 or 5 years.
Cameron Crowe, our thanks to Cameron for joining us today. His latest movie, Elizabethtown, is in theaters now.